Hello, James and Phil here from the Sunday Night Gold, back with another Raw podcast, the second in 2 days, because just as soon as we had finished yesterday's podcast, it was rendered completely and utterly pointless, Phil, because Michael Beale has left Sunderland. Your instant reaction to that, and a bit of a crazy day yesterday.
Yeah, it was a remarkable day. I suppose we're sort of used to them now, covering this club, but, you know, for the short time that Beale was at the club, you know, it was just an unbelievably up and down spell, wasn't it? I don't think I've ever quite known a spell as intense, really. Maybe you could argue when, you know, Stuart Donald and Charlie Methven first came in and you had things like Jack Rodwell, Papi Gilabogi, the manager hunt. That was a pretty intense period, but I think potentially this even tops that because you had all the games going on at the same time, you know, a championship playoff race. So yeah, my instant reaction kind of reflected on the day really was that a couple of things was that, you know, one, it is, have it right, it's hugely embarrassing for the club's ownership because it's not really that long since they've been out of the headlines for the Black Cats bar debacle. And now this, you know, whether the shortest permanent tenure in Sunderland's history. So to be in the headlines for all the kind of wrong reasons again, it's not a great look, it's not a great feeling. At the same time, I think it probably is the right decision for Sunderland's season, really. I think that probably handshake gate, whatever the rights or wrongs of it or what happened, probably underlined that it just wasn't happening. It just wasn't happening. And ultimately as well, like, the performances were just going nowhere. It was one step forward and two steps back every time. And so I do think it's the right decision. Mike Dodds is pretty popular in that dressing room. He showed he's got some decent tactical nous in the previous games he took. So, bit of an embarrassing day, I think, in a lot of ways for Sunderland. Having said that, I do sort of respect, you make a mistake, you own it and you correct it. And at least we've seen that happen while the season still everything's there to play for, just.
Indeed. I think Michael Beale's tenure lasted exactly 2 months and 1 day, 12 games, 4 wins, 2 draws, 6 losses, ends with a win percentage of 33.3%. The shortest managerial tenure in Sunderland's entire history, excluding Niall Quinn, who I don't really think you can count because he appointed himself and then sacked himself. So it's been crazy. Phil, how fast did this develop? Because yesterday morning, we didn't think this was going to happen. And then we sort of did some inquiries and it seemed to progress really, really fast, didn't it?
Yeah, I think there's two elements to that. So the actual event itself happened really, really fast. So as of Sunday night, Michael Beale was still the Sunderland head coach. Mm-hmm. As of Monday lunchtime, he was not the Sunderland head coach. And it genuinely, that was how quickly it happened on Monday. But what I would also say is, as ever with these things, I think it has been bubbling away in terms of, you know, the very top of the club for a little while. I know that there was a lot of concern about the performances for a long stretch. I don't know if it really went away. I don't think there was enough evidence. All the things we're talking about, you know, in terms of I'm concerned that how the XG is dropping off, what does that tell us about where the team's headed? You know, Sunderland have all of that, but even more advanced and even more sophisticated. So they see exactly what we see. And so there were those concerns. I also think that quite extraordinary press conference before the Stoke game where Beale talked about, you know, feeling he needed more respect and that fans didn't want him because of partially where he's from and stuff. You know, at the time that went down really, really badly. And so I think that Stoke game was an already a big pressure point. As it happened, he won that game, ended up with 7 points from 9, didn't he, which delayed it. But even within that, as we talked about at the time, you know, the Middlesbrough performance, there were some pretty severe red flags in that performance, weren't there? So it was like, so yeah, the answer is it's I think it's been, there's been a fear for a little while, I think, at the top of the club that this really isn't working on the pitch and off the pitch. And I think that, you know, those last two games, everything that happened with the handshake gate, but the actual performances themselves, I think just underlined everything really that we'd already been seeing. And that's why the decision was made. But in terms of the actual sequence of events, it was a very quick process on Monday. And I think, you know, the statement stays very clear, doesn't it, of using any terms like part company, mutual consent or sacked or anything like that. And I think that is a reflection of the fact that genuinely in this case, I think that obviously it's a club decision, but I think there was a genuine acceptance from everyone involved here that, you know what, this actually isn't working. To be honest, it's probably not going to work. There's already too much water under the bridge. And it's kind of impossible to see this turning around. So, yeah, I feel like that answer was longer than you were intending it to be from your question. But there we go.
Yeah, absolutely fine. That's actually a question that a couple of people have asked me. Is this a sacking or is it a mutual decision? And my sort of answer, and you've sort of touched on it there, but you can elaborate if you'd like to, is that yes, he's been sacked, but it's been done after a conversation and a mutual sort of parting of the ways, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's how I'd describe it. I think the club have obviously been considering a change for a while, as I hope that I've explained the background to that. But I think sometimes, yeah, I genuinely think that off the back of last week, everyone accepted that, you know what, this isn't working, and realistically it's not going to turn around. So maybe it's probably a reason why someone haven't quite used the word mutual consent in the statement, because that's probably pushing it a little bit, but I think there is an element of that. So yeah, I think that, you know, from my understanding, in the end it was relatively amiable in terms of saying, you know what, this, we came into this with the best of intentions all around, but it just hasn't worked. So yeah, that would kind of be how I would describe it.
I actually think as well, Phil, that as well as being absolutely the best thing for Sunderland and the playing staff, I think this is actually the best thing for Michael Beale as well, because it felt like he was on a hide and nothing. Some of that was his own doing, absolutely. Wasn't the right personality for Sunderland, wasn't the right fit. He was always going to struggle to recover from everything that had gone on, having to apologise after the Coventry game, his very first game in charge. You mentioned the pre-Stoke press conference. A lot of water under the bridge. We did briefly feel like that relationship could have gone some way to being healed, but then results have dropped off again. And you do, although we criticise him in a professional level, you do have to feel for him on a personal level, because he's crashed out of two high-profile jobs in Rangers and Sunderland. You know, a promising coaching career is hit the buffers a little bit. He's obviously got the family issues as well, so we wish them well. But it's sort of, yeah, I think the wrong man at the wrong time, really, Phil, unfortunately for Michael Beale.
He was given a really difficult task, really, in terms of replacing someone who was very, very popular, and who, for all the intensity of the debates about strikers and finishing chances and, you know, away form and stuff like that, was, let's be honest, doing pretty well at the time he was dismissed. Yeah. So that was a really difficult situation for Michael Beale. It wasn't his fault, as you say, that people weren't really having him. I totally disagree with his assessment that it didn't matter what happened on the pitch, people wouldn't be behind him. I think that was completely wrong. I don't think that was right at all. The geography thing, like, listen, I understand that it's difficult to be under that level of pressure and scrutiny, and we're all human beings, but, you know, you look at
ask Kevin Phillips and Kevin Ball
that's exactly what I was saying. But it's also a fact that, you know, a lot of people were unconvinced, and that was difficult for him to come into. But I think that, you know, fundamentally what I would say as well is, and why I disagreed with his comments on that, is that we all saw what was happening on the pitch, right? Which was, there was an effort to make the team harder to beat, which is fine, but it didn't actually change what was happening in terms of the defence and the results. And it also took away from the best strengths of the team. So everything stemmed from that. Let's have that right. Like, if Michael Beale had taken over, kept the style of play, while also making some tweaks that improved the results, people might not have been like, oh, you know, I'm absolutely loving his press conferences and stuff, but he would have been fine. Do you know what I mean? Like, the main thing is people want to go and watch their football team play well and win. So everything stemmed from the fact that ultimately the team went backwards. You know, I do believe that on the pitch. And that's, you know, we know how, you know, sort of data-driven and evidence-based, I think, would be the buzzword that Sunderland are. And that's why these doubts grew. I think you could also say that while you sympathise with the difficulty of the situation and the fact that you probably did feel like a bit of an outsider, very difficult to come into a job entirely on your own. That's one thing. Like, when we talk
about that, is a weird situation, isn't it? It is a strange.
Yeah, I can understand it in terms of wanting to keep the continuity of the coach and staff. I do think that's important, but like, it's not coming with anyone. You know, after the derby, really bruising weekend, like, who's there for him, who he really trusts to lean on, and who's speaking to him before he goes and does that pre-Stoke press conference and sort of goes, do you think? Like, so that, I do have a lot of sympathy, because it was a really, he must have felt really isolated at times, and I genuinely understand that. And some of his comments and views probably to me, come from a man not just under pressure, but probably feeling very isolated and maybe feeling like he didn't really have anyone in his corner. And so in that sense, a lot of it was a very human reaction. But like I say, I disagree with the idea that he never had a chance. I admit that it was a really difficult situation for him to come into. But the fundamental fact is that people who go and watch Sunderland games have watched a lot of football, and they could see that the team wasn't improving from the one that Tony Mowbray had left. Just my opinion, but I have to say I feel it pretty strongly.
And you mentioned it yesterday, Phil, but the idea was to tighten Sunderland up, which I don't think any of us would have disagreed with, but we're still conceding goals and losing games.
Yeah. Sorry, can you just repeat that? I got a bit distracted for a moment.
No. I was just saying that, the idea from Michael Beale was to tighten up things at the back, wasn't it? But you made the point yesterday that Sunderland was still conceding goals and losing games.
Yeah, absolutely. So, there were some games where you're thinking, yeah, the opposition are really struggling to play through Sunderland here, and Anthony Patterson's not making loads of saves. But I just felt like what we were still seeing was, the defensive lapses, maybe the concentration, the intensity not always been brilliant. And that's kind of what you expect from such a young team, isn't it? So I think you took, when you have a group of young, exciting, technical players, surely you should be setting up in a way to get the best out of that and to play to your strengths. And sometimes I felt like Sunderland were, by playing this slightly more negative style, were accentuating their weaknesses, to be honest. It didn't make a huge amount of sense to me. And you can understand why fans came away from games feeling a little bit underwhelmed, when you compare to some of the football they saw last year.
Another question people keep asking me, and it's speculation which is going to rumble on for the rest of the season, unfortunately, but where does Sunderland go next? Obviously, we know that Mike Dodds is in interim charge until the end of the season, but I find this question really hard to answer, really hard to predict, because God knows what's going to happen between now and the summer. God knows what sort of club Sunderland will be come the summer. God knows who will be available in the summer. It's a very strange situation. And one thing I wanted to get your thoughts on, Phil, if Mike Dodds really does really well, then Sunderland may well appoint him, but that provides its own problems in a sense, because Mike Dodds is really highly rated in the coaching staff, integral part of the club. And if you appoint him as manager on a full-time basis, inevitably he's going to have to leave at some point. Either he gets poached or you have to sack him. So it's a weird, bizarre situation Sunderland find themselves in now.
Yeah. First of all, just to answer David Priest asking where my beanie is. I've got a couple of new beanies in the post-pre-season. So when we do the podcast next week, you'll be able to see my new range of beanies. I'll model them both for you. So that's something for you to look forward to. hope you're keeping well, David. Always very, very good to hear from you. In terms of the Dodds thing, I think ultimately what you mentioned is the reason why he didn't get the job until the end of the season last time when Tony Mowbray left. So initially, we don't need to go into names. I think everyone's got a fair idea what happened. Sunderland had some candidates that they really liked, couldn't get them at this stage in the season, financial reasons, logistic reasons. So you're then left with, Beale, who you spoke to in the interview process and really liked, or Dodds, who's doing well, and the strengths are kind of obvious, aren't they? So the decision was, the thinking was pretty much as you said, look, if we go on a poor run and we're left in a really difficult situation where we may have to lose someone who we think has a huge future at the club, whether it is just part of the coaching staff or as a future head coach. So that was why, they decided it was a bit too soon for him. And I suppose that issue is still potentially there now. It's a really difficult fixture list. What if someone play okay, but just get beaten by teams with bigger budgets, and all of a sudden the season's gone and there's still 8 or 9 games left for Mike Dodds to manage? I worry about that a bit, not too much, just because I think that supporters have now seen and know Dodds well enough to know what he brings, I think. So I think there will be that of an understanding in terms of what he can bring to the club in the long term. For your initial question in terms of what happens next, I think that's a really interesting question. My view is that the ideal scenario for Sunderland is, and this has happened by accident rather than by design, so I'm not trying to sort of praise it and say how brilliant it is. Maybe the best thing is to actually have the time and space to do their proper, I know everyone hates the word, but process. Because I feel like we know that Mowbray essentially got sacked because he fell out with the club's ownership and it escalated really quickly. Yeah. What then happened suggested to me that they weren't really ready to go through their recruitment process. And I think that maybe now they've actually got a spell of time for 2-3 months where they can actually do that properly. and sort of go through that process and hopefully arrive at the right candidate. So I think it's kind of a best case scenario that they've actually got time to breathe. And in the summer, the kind of candidate that they were looking for a few months ago might well be available and might well be easier to get. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that's how it plays out. That's probably a slightly idealistic version of how I see it going. But I do think there's a scenario where it turns out that they can make the decision that they probably wanted to make in December, but we'll see.
Yeah, apologies for my dog. She's barking her way, the lads. I think anyway, one thing
she's disagreeing with me. She's thinking, yeah, what a load of absolute rubbish he speaks. I'm sick of it. Every day I have to listen to his nonsense.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, Phil, and it's another question that people sort of keep asking, or another talking point, is who actually really appoints the manager at Sunderland? And I ask this because it does feel like sometimes that there's a difference in strategy in terms of, you know, the flirtation with Roy Keane was very different to ending up with Alex Neil, and the flirtation with Will Still was very different to ending up with Michael Beale. Is it all on Speakman? Is it a joint effort with Kirilou Dreyfus and Juan Satori having a little bit of ownership in that decision-making process? And I ask this because obviously the Sunderland Till I Die documentary, we see both of Sunderland's corners talking about that very, you know, topical issue, as you would expect, they own the club. But I find that fascinating because if I had to put money on it, the Roy Keane flirtation wasn't something that was probably driven by Christian Speakman.
I think we can draw fairly our own thoughts on that, can't we? Because we know Christian Speakman fairly well. We listen to him. We see what he says. And we see Roy Keane on a Sunday. And we hear what he says. So I'm just going to leave those two things there. I think what that essentially tells you is that how all football clubs work. People can make decisions, have ideas, run processes. Who ultimately decides? The owner. So maybe sometimes when the manager goes and you think that's slightly odd timing, that maybe tells you that there's some you know, decisions being made at the top rather than it always being entirely logical and entirely in a process sort of driven way. I hate using that word, but it is the best way to describe it. So essentially what happens is that someone run an interview process. Christian Speakman oversees that. There'll be other people from the club will sit on it just sort of to ask questions, you know, like, I'm thinking figures like, not that they would decide who gets it, but people who might sit on the interview panel might be people like Robin Nichols, the academy manager. Stuart Harvey maybe would be somebody. One of the non-executive directors might sit on an interview panel, David Jones, somebody like that. And then what happens is they'll obviously go through the interview process and they'll make a recommendation to Kirill and the board. Obviously, what would normally, you know, happen is that Kirill and the board will say, yes, we accept your recommendation, but ultimately, the ownership, Kirilou, Jason Wansatori, run the football club. It's they put the money in. They are the owners. They ultimately make the site. So if they decide they want to put somebody into that interview process, then it happens, doesn't it? And if they decide that they want somebody to get the job, then ultimately that's what happens. I'm making it sound a bit more chaotic than it is, because I think generally speaking, I think Christian Speakman does make the decisions and his recommendations are listened to and heeded. But I think sometimes, you know, things can run away a little bit, and I do think Roy Keane's a perfect example of that, whereby I think that ran away very, very quickly from Sunderland. I'm not sure that was probably what Christian Speakman had in mind at the start of the process, if you catch my drift. So yeah, I think, as I say, I'm actually relative, if Mike Dodds can make a decent start and keep the campaign on track, I'm relatively hopeful that this will allow them to actually run, probably for the first time since they took charge of the club, quite a calm and actual sort of long recruitment process, whereby they can sort of get it done and without that outside noise, without the pressure of who's going to take the game on Saturday, we need to get somebody in or what's going on. And hopefully that can lead to a better outcome than the last one. And I do think that the thing is, like, the summer thing is really important. Like, you want to appoint a manager in the summer. A, if you want to take someone from elsewhere, it's much, much easier to do it in the summer. B, it then means that they have a full pre-season with the players so you can actually get their ideas in early on. So that's my hope. I think, like, and as I say, I'm not trying to, like, paint a happy picture. It's very much happened by accident rather than by design. So, yeah, that's how I feel about it anyway. And so the answer to your question is Christian Speakman makes the decisions, but we shouldn't pretend that he is the ultimate decision maker at the club. That is absolutely not the case. That's Kyle Louis-Dreyfus, and that's why sometimes, as you alluded to, sometimes you can put two and two, like two things together, and wonder where on earth it's come from. That's the reality of why that happens.
I'm really interested in this accident or design thesis that you've just raised there, in a sense, and I'll explain my reasoning, because this centres around Sunderland approaching out-of-work managers because they don't have to pay the compensation. Now, they've probably ended up having to pay Beale some money to get him out of his contract, so you could argue that that was a busted flush anyway, and they should have just gone and got the guy that they really wanted initially.
The difference, sorry to interrupt, but because a couple of people mentioned that, the difference will be huge.
Yeah,
I would suggest.
Yeah, from Will Still, who was in the it was in the millions, wasn't it? Yeah. But anyway, you could argue you could argue that Sunderland have lost money. Now, I want to go back a little bit, because obviously I mentioned there was the flirtation with Roy Keane, and then is it accident or design that sort of Sunderland stumbled upon Alex Neil because he applied and was the best out of work candidate? They didn't expect Alex Neil to leave, but then Tony Mowbray had that Stuart Harvey connection from Blackburn. It just so happened that he was out of work. And I sort of see these two camps on social media, and I struggle to work out where I fit into this, because yes, they've appointed two out of three good coaches really in Alex Neil and Tony Mowbray, who you could judge as being a success. They did that, they made those decisions, but did they just sort of stumble upon them? And is Beale the sort of example that you use, that when, you know, they can get things wrong? And I've explained that horrifically, but hopefully you get what I'm saying.
So I'd say two things, right? So the Mowbray one, if they stumbled upon it, then that was good stumbling, because Alex Neil kind of left from nowhere, and they made a quick decision that Tony Mowbray, it was convenient, and it did, you know, work very well. But it did. It made total sense, and it was a good judgment call in the pressure situation. So I think that's good stumbling. I think sometimes in life and in football, you have to stumble. And I thought that was some good stumbling to reach.
This is what we've become on this podcast, is good stumbling.
No, but I think it's true, right? So, like, you know, yes, you can have your processes and your data, but sometimes you just got to respond to what's in front of you and show a bit of nous and common sense. And I thought the Mowbray one was a perfect example of that. And if it was helpful that his good friend was the head of recruitment, then so be it. The Alex Neil one, I know that's come around because of obviously the interview on Sunderland Till I Die, didn't he, when he said his agent put in touch with Sunderland. I've got to be honest, I think it's a little disrespectful to Sunderland to suggest that they weren't aware of Alex Neil's qualities, his playoff record, the fact that he'd been a very, very good championship manager for a number of years, the fact that he had a track record of being one of the best coaches out of possession outside of the Premier League, the fact that he'd made an instant impact at that point at every club he went to. You know, I understand it, but I think we need to give them a little bit more credit than that, actually. I think they knew who Alex Neil was, and I think he was a contender for the job. The Roy Keane thing and how that all happened and why it happened and the impact that had is a very different conversation, which was less good, I would suggest, for everyone involved. So, I don't know. I feel like it's interesting, because actually I feel like ultimately, even if, as you explained, they were both kind of convenient, Mowbray and Neil were two very, very good choices, and that gave me some trust in what they were doing, the questions they were asking, the research they were doing, the clarity of what they were looking for, even if, you know, the Neil one was a really muddled process. This one really makes you go, what on earth happened there? And it does, you know, there's no other way to say it other than it makes you question what the judgment is a little bit, because did they discuss what the style of play was going to be and the changes that were going to be made on the pitch? If they did, why did they think that was a good idea when all the messaging is about front foot football and, you know, the club's mission statement is like bold, creative, industrious, you know, and it's how did that happen? Beale had struggled with communication at Rangers. Why did they not think that was going to happen again at another big club of this size? So I can understand why off the back of that, people then go back and question those other two. I think that's more than fair. I'm a lot more forgiven, I think, in terms of, I think those two decisions were good ones at the right time, but definitely you're looking forward thinking, you know, I can totally understand anyone saying, well, how am I supposed to trust them to get it right in the summer, you know, after this one? My opinion is, I think I've probably expressed a bit on this podcast, was that they were left on the back foot by an impulsive decision being made because Mowbray had fallen out and there'd been some disagreements. My strong opinion was that Mowbray, if they really, really want to make change, they should have done it last summer and got a preferred candidate in at that point, or they should have let Mowbray do his work and see it through the other summer, because you can absolutely guarantee that there would have still been a decent season. So in my opinion, the Beale mess, if you like, the Beale debacle, came from an impulsive decision that was made at the wrong time that left the recruitment process basically gone from a standing start. That's how I see it anyway. Everyone will have their own opinions as well, and massively respect that.
The last time, Phil, that Sunderland had a manager that completed the season from pre-season to finish was Jack Ross. It's my ambition that I will see a Sunderland manager complete the season again while I'm still in this job covering this club. I think it's, you do need that long-term stability, don't you, at some point. I think it's 22 permanent managers in 22 years as well, I read, with a whole host of caretakers in there as well. You know, after the stability of the sort of Peter Reid years of the late 90s and early 2000s, you're looking at Steve Bruce, maybe the longest serving manager, with possibly Gus Poyet or Roy Keane behind him. It's not great, is it? And you do need some stability at a football club at some point. I do get the argument that, you know, head coaches can be interchangeable and they shouldn't be the most important thing at the football club anymore. You should be able to swap them in and out without having, you know, major disasters and the whole operation falling apart, because, you know, football clubs have changed and those roles are more shared out now. It's not just all on the manager, but at some point it would be nice to get through a season or even a calendar year.
Yeah. Well, I suppose you kind of alluded to that. I would, plain devil's advocate, I suppose you could flip it and say Christian Speakman's now been in post for like 3 years, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Which, given that he's the most important football decision maker at the club, a club of Sunderland size, you could argue that's quite remarkable, unprecedented level of stability. I agree with you. I do think that ultimately, you know, the role of the head coach has changed, and that's partially reflected in the churn, if you like. But the last 8 months has not just been natural, sort of interchangeable and sort of natural churn. It has been chaos, let's be honest. The doubt over Mowbray's future sort of last summer was chaos, really. I rumbled on in the season, as I've outlined. The strange timing of his dismissal was just, for me, was like the worst of all worlds in the end. It destabilised the team and didn't really give them actually a good chance of making tangible improvements in the short term. And the Beale, you know, let's not pretend that's just like natural. What's happened over the last couple of months is just a natural thing that happens in football. So I totally agree with you. It's really sort of damning how this has played out for the ownership, and especially for like a regime that really prides itself on like evidence-based decisions, calm decision-making, stability. It's a really, really bad look. And this summer appointment is really huge. And yeah, I agree with you. I'm sort of, as I think I've outlined, I'm trying to see this positive scenario where they've got time to get that candidate that kind of always wanted all along, and it's a bit easier to do it in the summer. And you can maybe sort of reset a little bit and get that stability. But, you know, if there's anyone, Sunderland fans, waking up this morning and thinking, after what's gone on, I don't really kind of trust them to do that, then I totally understand that. It's an interesting comment Bruce has just put up there. He's chosen 3 coaches in 2 years and all have been sacked or left. It's really interesting, though, isn't it? Because, like,
that happens everywhere as well, you know.
two of them left the team in a better place than they picked it up, though. So that's interesting, isn't it? It's like, is that a failure? Or are they 2 really good decisions? You could literally argue either way. Like Bruce's point is right, it's not a great look. But 2 of those really did leave the team in a better place than it initially had. So like, but let's not, I'm not trying to like suggest that this is all just like great, let's just change managers every 60 days. That is absolutely not the case. But
I really can't, be doing with a managerial change every 60 days.
Oh, you love it, don't lie. You love the drama.
I do love the drama. Anyway, we're approaching 30 minutes, but one quick last question. Thank you to everybody who's got in touch on social media with comments. There's been David, Michael, Tom, John, Gordon, Bruce as well. But I'm just going to put a question up on the screen from John and then ask my own as well. Phil, how do you think Sunderland will set up on Saturday, Swansea being a possession-based side? And I guess the crux of the matter is that what does a Michael Beale team look like in comparison to a Mike Dodds team, and what is Mike Dodds likely to change? Obviously, we have some material that we can look at earlier on in the season against, I think it was West Brom, Leeds and Bristol Rovers. Yeah. Bristol City, sorry, it was away.
Bristol City, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, what's going to be the difference? What will Mike Dodds be able to do?
Well, I think that what was interesting about the Dodds era was that, I said Dodds era, it was three games, don't you mean? The West Brom and the Bristol City games were really interesting, and it was basically just the Mowbray template. Dodds had obviously had quite a big hand in all of that because he had Mowbray was a fantastic delegator. You know, he didn't have that ego about him. He let the coaching staff have their input and their views. And so that's kind of how I expect to see Sunderland on Saturday. I expect it to look a bit like a Mowbray team. I think it'll be back to more of a sort of 4-2-3-1 rather than a 4-3-3, if that makes sense. I think it will be a bit more open, probably a bit more front-footed. That's partially because the Swansea are such an open attacking team. And I think Sunderland will probably just say, you know what, if we have a really open game, I reckon our players are better than theirs and we'll come out on top. Obviously, what's interesting then is the games afterwards when Sunderland play much tougher opponents. I think Dodds really impressed us in that Leeds game because he tweaked the style and the formation for what was in front of Sunderland. It was still good to watch.
Best performance of the season, arguably, that.
Yeah, it was still really good to watch and it was committed and intense and it wasn't negative, but it was just pragmatic. And so Saturday, I expected to look pretty much like a Mowbray / Dodds team. But then after that, it's going to be really interesting to see Dodds how manages those completely different games.
Because a lot of people have said on social media and whatnot, yes, but is Dodds not part of the problem because he's under the coaching staff of Michael Beale? But I actually feel that Mike Dodds's football, from what we've seen, the brief games that we've seen, and you've just mentioned, I feel that it is noticeably different to Michael Beale's sort of philosophy in terms of, you know, the 4-3-3 that you mentioned, keeping it tight, sort of shackled Sunderland's attack a little bit, didn't it? But I think Mike Dodds, his philosophy is noticeably different.
From what we've seen so far, I would agree. And listen, we'll judge that after the games that are coming up, aren't they? But yeah, I take the point. And all the staff and all the players have to be accountable for the performance.
Oh, absolutely.
Not just Michael Beale, so totally. But I agree with you. I think with Dodds solely in charge, I think we will see it differently. Hopefully we do.
And then again, there's a massive chance that come 7 o'clock on Saturday evening, we're all talking about Sunderland's lack of strikers. We're back to square one, and it's all guns pointed at Christian Speakman and the recruitment team again. It feels sort of cyclical, sort of, you know, that rotation, that churn in narrative. It just seems to spring back up every time, doesn't it? And you could see that happening again.
Yeah, definitely. We will definitely be talking about strikers at 7 o'clock on Saturday, whatever happens. So we'll just make our peace with it. And
hopefully it's Roosen bagging a hat-trick. That would be nice.
Yeah, exactly. Let's think that way. Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant. Right. Well, you can head over to the Sunderland Echo website for all of the latest on the Michael Beale fallout. What next for Mike Dodds? What next for Sunderland? Plus the Swansea City game at the Stadium of Light. We'll also have will there be a pre-match press conference, Phil? At some point,
I hope. Yes, I would have thought there will be on Thursday, but obviously that's not confirmed yet. But well,
stick with us. Stick with us for that as well. You can find this podcast on all good podcast places and on YouTube. Head over to YouTube as well for Phil's On the Whistle. He did a special on Michael Beale's sacking, which is well worth a watch. And thank you once again for listening to the Raw Podcast.